Cultural identity is always a slippery notion, and we have no idea how early Romans thought about their particular character and what distinguished them from their neighbours. But the distinctive, hard-edged sense of tough Roman austerity, which later Romans eagerly projected back onto their founding fathers, and which has remained a powerful vision of Romanness into the modern world, was the product of a powerful cultural clash in this period of expansion abroad over what it was to be Roman in this new, wider imperial world, and in the context of such an array of alternatives. To put it another way, Greekness and Romanness were as inseparably bound up as they were polar opposites. That is exactly what we see in a particularly vertiginous form in the story Livy, among others, tells of how the great mother goddess was brought into Rome with tremendous fanfare from Asia Minor in 204 BCE, towards the end of the Second Punic War. This was a very Roman occasion. A book of Roman oracles that was supposed to go back to the reign of the Tarquins recommended that the goddess Cybele, as she was also known, be incorporated into the Roman pantheon. The range of deities worshipped in Rome was proudly elastic, and the Great Mother was the patron deity of the Romans' ancestral home, Aeneas's Troy, and so, in a sense, belonged in Italy. They sent a senior deputation to collect the image of the goddess and transport her back, and they chose, as the oracle had insisted, the best man in the state to receive her in Rome, who turned out to be another Scipio. He was accompanied in the welcoming party by a noble Roman woman, in some accounts a Vestal Virgin, and the image was taken from the ship and passed from the coast to the city, hand to hand, by a long line of other women. The goddess was temporarily lodged in the Shrine of Victory until her own temple was built. It would be the first building in Rome, so far as we know, constructed using the most Roman of materials, and the one on which so many of the Romans' later architectural masterpieces relied. Concrete. Nothing could have pleased Cato more, except that not everything was quite as it seemed. The image of the goddess was not what the Romans could possibly have been expecting. It was a large black meteorite, not a conventional statue in human form. And the meteorite came accompanied by a retinue of priests. These were self-castrated eunuchs with long-haired tambourines and a passion for self-flagellation. This was all about as un-Roman as you could imagine, and forever after it raised uncomfortable questions about the Roman and the foreign and where the boundary between them lay. If this was the kind of thing that came from Rome's ancestral home, what did that imply about what it was to be Roman? Chapter 6. New Politics. Destruction. The long siege and final destruction of Carthage in 146 BCE was gruesome even by ancient standards, with atrocities reported on both sides. The losers could be as spectacularly cruel as the victors. On one occasion, the Carthaginians were supposed to have paraded Roman prisoners on the city walls, flayed them alive, and dismembered them in full view of their comrades. Carthage lay on the Mediterranean coast near modern Tunis and was defended by a massive circuit of walls almost 20 miles in perimeter. The walls of Rome constructed after the invasion of the Gauls were well under half that length. It was only when Scipio Aemilianus had cut the town off from the sea, and so from its access to supplies, that after 2 years of siege operations, the Romans managed to starve the enemy into submission and storm the place. The one surviving ancient description of these final moments includes plenty of lurid exaggeration, but also a shrewd sense of how difficult it must have been to destroy a city as solidly built as Carthage, and a few probably realistic glimpses of the carnage that went with defeat. In the assault, the Roman soldiers fought their way up streets lined with multi-story buildings. They jumped from rooftop to rooftop, throwing the occupants down onto the pavements and toppling and setting fire to the structures as they went, until the debris they had made blocked their path. The rubbish clearers followed, opening up a space for the next wave of assault by blasting their way through the mixture of building material and human remains, in which it was said that the legs of the dying could be seen visibly writhing above the debris, their heads and bodies buried beneath. The bones that archaeologists have found in these layers of destruction, not to mention the thousands of deadly stone and clay sling bullets that have been unearthed, suggest that this description may not be as wide of the mark as we might hope. There was the usual rush for plunder, and not just precious gold and silver. Aemilianus made sure that the famous agricultural encyclopedia by the Carthaginian Mago was rescued from the flames. Back in Rome, the Senate gave a committee of Roman linguists the unenviable task of translating into Latin its 28 volumes on everything from how to preserve pomegranates to how to choose bullocks. There were mythical resonances too. Aemilianus's rueful quotation from Homer as he watched the destruction had its poignant side, but it was also a boast. Rome was now claiming its place in the cycle of great powers and great conflicts that started with the Trojan War. Carthage, meanwhile, was supposed to have ended as it had begun, with a man abandoning his lover in favour of Rome. One story told that just as Virgil's hero Aeneas deserted Dido as the city was being built, so amid its destruction, Hasdrubal, the Carthaginian commander, finally went over to the Romans, leaving his wife behind. She is supposed to have denounced him when, like Dido, she threw herself onto a funeral pyre. Almost as devastating, a few months later, was the sack of Corinth, nearly 1,000 miles from Carthage and the richest city in Greece. It had made a fortune from its prime trading position, with harbours on each side of the narrow strip of land separating the Peloponnese from the rest of Greece. Under the command of Lucius Mummius Archicus, as he was later known from his victory over these Achaeans, the Roman legions took the place apart, looted its fabulous works of art, enslaved the people, and set it ablaze. This was such a vast conflagration that the mixture of molten metal it produced was supposed to be the origin of a prized and extremely expensive material known as Corinthian bronze. Ancient experts did not believe a word of this particular story, but the image of the intense heat of the destruction, melting first the precious bronze, then the silver, and finally the gold, until they all streamed together, is a powerful one, and a vivid example of the close link in Roman imagination between art and conquest. Mummius was a very different type from the Homer-loving Aemilianus, and he has gone down in history almost as a caricature of the uncultured Roman Philistine. Polybius, who arrived at Corinth shortly after the Greek defeat, was shocked to see Roman soldiers using the backs of precious paintings as gaming boards, presumably with the nod of their commanding officer. And a joke was still circulating almost 7 centuries later about how, when he was overseeing the shipment of the valuable antiques back home, Mummius told the captains that if any piece was damaged, they would have to replace it with a new one. He was, in other words, so laughably boorish that he was unaware that a new-for-old deal was inappropriate for such valuable antiques. But this story was, like so many, double-edged. At least one stern Roman commentator took a stance, reminiscent of Cato, in suggesting that it would have been better for Rome if more people had followed Mummius and kept their distance from Greek luxury. Perhaps a tradition of austerity ran in Mummius's family, for his great-great-grandson was the notoriously parsimonious and no-nonsense emperor, Galba, who ruled for a few months in 68 to 69 CE after the downfall of the extravagant Nero. But whatever his views really were, Mummius disposed of the Corinthian spoils with care. Some were dedicated in temples in Greece, combining a show of piety with a subtle warning to the other Greeks. Many were put on display in Rome or presented to towns in Italy. Evidence for this is still emerging. In Pompeii, in the precinct of the Temple of Apollo, just off the Forum, a statue plinth was cleaned in 2002, and under a later plaster coating was discovered an inscription in Oscan, the local language, proclaiming that whatever once stood on top of it had been a gift of L. Mummius L. Consul, or Lucius Mummius, son of Lucius Consul. It must have been some choice object from Corinth. Why, within the space of a few months, the Romans took such brutal measures against these two grand and famous cities has been debated ever since. After Africanus's victory at the Battle of Zama in 202 BCE, at the end of the war with Hannibal, Carthage had agreed to Rome's demands. 50 years later, it had just paid off the last instalment of the vast cash indemnity the Romans had imposed. Was this final campaign of destruction simply an act of Roman vengeance, carried out on some trumped-up excuse? Or did the Romans have a legitimate fear of resurgent Carthaginian power, whether economic or military? Cato was the most vociferous enemy of Carthage, notoriously, tediously, but ultimately persuasively, ending every speech he made with the words, "Carthage must be destroyed. Carthago delenda est," in the still familiar Latin phrase. One of his stunts in the Senate was letting a bunch of deliciously ripe Carthaginian figs drop from his toga. He then explained that they had come from a city only 3 days' journey away. This was a wilful underestimate of the distance between Carthage and Rome. Just under 5 days would have been the quickest journey. But it was a powerful symbol of the dangerous proximity and agricultural wealth of a potential rival, and intended to provoke suspicion of the old enemy. Corinth must have played a rather different role in Roman calculations. It had been one of several Greek cities to ignore some rather half-hearted and not very clear instructions that Rome had given in the 140s BCE, trying to restrict alliances in the Greek world, and it had pursued its own agenda in regional politics. Worse still, the Corinthians had rudely sent packing a delegation of Roman envoys. No other place in Greece came in for the same treatment. Was Corinth being punished as an exemplary case for a public act of disobedience, even though it had been on a relatively trivial scale? Or was there a real suspicion that it could become an alternative power base in the eastern Mediterranean? Or, as Polybius insinuates at the end of his histories, were the Romans starting to resort to extermination for its own sake? Whatever motivations lay behind the violence of 146 BCE, the events of that year were soon seen as a turning point. In one way, they marked the acme of Roman military success. Rome had now annihilated its richest, oldest, and most powerful rivals in the Mediterranean world. As Virgil presented it more than 100 years later in the Aeneid, Mummius, by conquering Corinth, had at last avenged the defeat of Aeneas's Trojans by the Greeks in the Trojan War. But in another way, the events of 146 BCE were seen as the beginning of the collapse of the Republic, and as the herald of a century of civil wars, mass murder, and assassinations that led to the return of autocratic rule. Fear of the enemy, so this argument went, had been good for Rome. Without any significant external threat, the path of virtue was abandoned for that of corruption. Sallust was particularly eloquent on the theme. In his other surviving essay on a war against the North African king Jugurtha at the end of the 2nd century BCE, he reflects on the dire consequences of the destruction of Carthage. From the greed of all sections of Roman society, every man for himself, through the breakdown of consensus between rich and poor, to the concentration of power in the hands of a very few men. These all pointed to the end of the republican system. Sallust was an acute observer of Roman power, but the collapse of the Republic was, as we shall see, not quite so easily explained. The legacy of Romulus and Remus. The period between 146 BCE and the assassination of Julius Caesar in 44 BCE, particularly its last 30 years, marked a high point of Roman literature, art, and culture. The poet Catullus was writing what still ranks as some of the world's most memorable love poetry, addressed to a Roman senator's wife, whose identity he, no doubt wisely, concealed under the pseudonym Lesbia. Cicero was drafting the speeches that have been some of the touchstones of oratory ever since, and was theorizing principles of rhetoric, good government, and even theology. Julius Caesar was composing an elegantly self-serving description of his campaigns in Gaul, one of the rare accounts by a general, or anyone else for that matter, of his own military operations to survive from the ancient world. And the city of Rome was on the verge of transforming from an unplanned rabbit warren into the impressive capital that we now have in our minds. The first permanent stone theatre opened in 55 BCE with a stage 95 metres wide, attached to a vast new complex of promenades, sculpture gardens and porticos supported on marble columns. Now buried underground near the modern Campo de' Fiori, it once covered an area significantly larger than the later Colosseum. Yet many Roman commentators focused on no such glittering achievements, but on progressive political and moral decline. Roman armies still won very lucrative and sometimes very bloody victories abroad. In 61 BCE, Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus, Pompey the Great, as he styled himself, in imitation of Alexander, celebrated a triumph of his victory over King Mithridates VI of Pontus, who once occupied extensive territories around the Black Sea coast, and had his eye on more. This was an even more spectacular occasion than the triumph of Aemilius Paulus a century before. The 75,100,000 drachmae of silver coin carried in the procession was the equivalent of the entire annual tax revenue of the empire. It would have been enough to feed 2 million people for a year, and a good part of it went towards building that first ostentatious theatre. In the 50s BCE, the campaigns in Gaul to the north, which were commanded and written up by Caesar, brought several million people under Roman control, not counting the million or so whom he is believed to have left dead in the process. Increasingly, however, Roman weapons were turned not against foreign enemies, but against Romans themselves. Never mind any thought of Aeneas's Trojans. This was the legacy of Romulus and Remus, the fratricidal twins. The blood of innocent Remus, as Horace put it in the 30s BCE, was taking its revenge. Looking back over the period, Roman historians regretted the gradual destruction of peaceful politics. Violence was increasingly taken for granted as a political tool. Traditional restraints and conventions broke down one by one, until swords, clubs, and rioting more or less replaced the ballot box. At the same time, to follow Sallust, a very few individuals of enormous power, wealth, and military backing came to dominate the state. Until Julius Caesar was officially made dictator for life, and then within weeks was assassinated in the name of liberty, when the story is stripped down to its barest and brutal essentials, it consists of a series of key moments and conflicts that led to the dissolution of the free state, a sequel of tipping points that marked the stages in the progressive degeneration of the political process, and a succession of atrocities that lingered in the Roman imagination for centuries. The first was in 133 BCE, when Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus, a tribune of the people with radical plans to distribute land to the Roman poor, decided to seek a second year in office. To put a stop to this, an unofficial posse of senators and their hangers-on interrupted the elections, bludgeoned Gracchus and hundreds of his supporters to death, and threw their bodies into the Tiber. Conveniently forgetting the violence that had accompanied the conflict of the orders, many Romans held this to be the first political dispute since the fall of the monarchy to be settled by bloodshed and the death of citizens. there was soon another. Just over a decade later, Tiberius Gracchus's brother, Gaius, met the same fate. He had introduced an even more radical programme of reform, including a subsidised grain allowance for Roman citizens, and was successfully elected tribune for a second time. But in 121 BCE, when he was trying to prevent his legislation from being dismantled, he became a victim of another, more official, posse of senators. On this occasion, the bodies of thousands of his supporters clogged the river. And it happened again in 100 BCE, when other reformers were battered to death in the Senate House itself, the assailants using tiles from the building's roof as their weapons. Three more sustained civil wars, or revolutionary uprisings, there is often a hazy boundary between them, followed in quick succession, and in a sense added up to an on-and-off single conflict lasting more than 20 years. First, war was declared on Rome in 91 BCE by a coalition of Italian allies, or socii, hence the quaint and deceptively harmonious modern title of social war. Within a couple of years, the Romans more or less defeated the allies, and in the process gave most of them full Roman citizenship. Even so, the death toll among men who had once served side by side in Rome's wars of expansion was, according to one Roman estimate, around 300,000. Exaggerated as that figure may be, it still points to casualties on a scale not far from that of the war against Hannibal. Before the social war was over, one of its commanders, Lucius Cornelius Sulla, a consul in 88 BCE, became the first Roman since the mythical Coriolanus to lead his army against the city of Rome. Sulla was forcing the hand of the Senate to give him command in a war in the east, and when he returned from that victorious 4 years later, he marched on his hometown once again and had himself appointed dictator. Before resigning in 79 BCE, he introduced a wholesale conservative reform programme and presided over a reign of terror and the first organised purge of political enemies in Roman history. In these proscriptions, that is, notices as they were known, in a chilling euphemism, the names of thousands of men, including about a third of all senators, were posted throughout Italy, a generous price on their heads for anyone cruel, greedy, or desperate enough to kill them. Finally, the fallout from both these conflicts fueled Spartacus's famous slave war, which began in 73 BCE and remains one of the most glamorized conflicts in the whole of Roman history. Brave as they were, this handful of breakaway slave gladiators must have been reinforced by many of the disaffected Roman citizens in Italy. They could hardly otherwise have stood up to the legions for almost 2 years. This was a combination of slave rebellion and civil war. By the 60s BCE, political order in Rome itself was repeatedly breaking down, replaced by street violence that became part of daily life. Catiline's conspiracy was only one such incident among many. There were any number of occasions when rioting prevented elections from taking place, or when massive bribery was supposed to have swayed the decision of the electorate or of juries in the courts, or when murder was the weapon of choice against a political opponent. Publius Clodius Pulcher, the brother of Catullus's Lesbia, and the man who engineered Cicero's exile in 58 BCE, was later killed by a gang of paramilitary slaves owned by one of Cicero's friends, in a seedy brawl in a city suburb. The Battle of Bovillae, as it was grandly and ironically known. Where exactly the responsibility for his death lay was never clear, but he was given an impromptu cremation in the Senate House, which burned down with him. By comparison, one controversial consul in 59 BCE got off lightly. He was merely pelted with excrement and spent the rest of his year of office barricaded at home. Against this background, three men, Pompey, Julius Caesar and Marcus Licinius Crassus, made an informal deal to use their combined influence, connections and money to fix the political process in their own interests. This gang of three, or three-headed monster, as one contemporary satirist put it, for the first time effectively took public decisions into private hands. Through a series of behind-the-scenes arrangements, bribes and threats, they ensured that consulships and military commands went where they chose and that key decisions went their way. This arrangement lasted for about a decade, starting around 60 BCE. Private deals are hard to date precisely. But then, seeking to secure his personal position, Julius Caesar decided to follow the precedent of Sulla and take over Rome by force. The essentials of what happened next are clear, even if the details are almost impenetrably complicated. Leaving Gaul in early 49 BCE, Caesar famously crossed the river Rubicon, which formed the boundary of Italy, and marched towards Rome. 40 years had made a big difference. When Sulla turned his army on the city, all but one of his senior officials had refused to follow him. When Caesar did the same, all but one stayed with him. It was an apt symbol of how far scruples had eroded in such a short time. The civil war that followed, in which Caesar and Pompey, the one-time allies, were now the rival commanders, spread throughout the Mediterranean world. Rome's internal conflicts were no longer restricted to Italy. The decisive battle was fought in central Greece, and Pompey ended up murdered on the coast of Egypt, beheaded by some Egyptian double-dealers he had imagined were his allies. This is a powerful story of political crisis and bloody disintegration, even told in its most skeletal form. Some of the underlying problems are obvious. The relatively small-scale political institutions of Rome, little changed since the 4th century BCE, were hardly up to governing the peninsula of Italy. They were even less capable of controlling and policing a vast empire. As we shall see, Rome relied more and more on the efforts and talents of individuals whose power, profits and rivalries threatened the very principles on which the Republic was based. And there was no backstop, not even a basic police force, to prevent political conflict from spilling over into murderous political violence in a huge metropolis of 1 million people by the mid-first century BCE, where hunger, exploitation and gross disparities of wealth were additional catalysts to protests, riots and crime. It is also a story that historians, both ancient and modern, tell with all the advantages and disadvantages of hindsight. Once the outcome is known, it is easy to present the period as a series of irrevocable and brutal steps in the direction of crisis, or as a slow countdown to both the end of the free state and the return of one-man rule. But the last century of the Republic was more than a mere bloodbath. As the flowering of poetry, theory, and art suggests, it was also a period when Romans grappled with the issues that were undermining their political process and came up with some of their greatest inventions, including the radical principle that the state had some responsibility for ensuring that its citizens had enough to eat. For the first time, they confronted the question of how an empire should be administered and governed, rather than simply acquired, and devised elaborate codes of practice for Roman rule. In other words, this was also an extraordinary period of political analysis and innovation. Roman senators did not sit idly by as their political institutions lapsed into chaos, nor did they simply fan the flames of the crisis to their own short-term advantage, though there was certainly a bit of that. Many of them, from different ends of the political spectrum, tried to find some effective remedies. We should not allow our hindsight, their ultimate failure, or the succession of civil wars and assassinations, to blind us to their efforts, which are the main theme of this and the next chapter. We shall look harder at some of the most famous conflicts and characters of the period to ask what exactly the Romans were arguing or fighting about. Some of the answers will take us back to the popular Manifesto of Liberty, embedded in the accounts and reconstructions of the conflict of the orders. But there are new issues, too. From the effect of the mass grant of full citizenship to the Italian allies, to the question of how the profits of the empire should be shared. These themes are all inextricably intertwined. The success or failure of armies serving overseas had direct consequences on the home front. The political ambitions of men like Pompey and Caesar lay behind some of the wars of conquest. There was never any clear divide between the military and political roles of the Roman elite. Nevertheless, in the interests of a clear account of these crucial but complicated developments, Chapter 7 focuses on Rome abroad and on the rise of the overpowering dynasts, especially Pompey and Caesar, in the later part of the period. For now, we will concentrate mainly on questions to do with Rome and Italy, and with the earlier part of the period, roughly, to put it in terms of some of the famous names that still dominate the narrative, from Tiberius Gracchus to Sulla and Spartacus. Tiberius Gracchus. In 137 BCE, Tiberius Gracchus, grandson of Scipio Africanus, a brother-in-law of Aemilianus, and a war hero at the siege of Carthage, where he had been the first to scale the enemy wall, was travelling north from Rome to join the legions in Spain. As he rode through Etruria, he was shocked at the state of the countryside, for the land was being worked, and the flocks tended, by foreign slaves on industrial-scale estates. The small peasant farmers, the traditional backbone of Italian agriculture, had disappeared. According to a pamphlet written by his younger brother Gaius, quoted in a much later biography, this was the moment when Tiberius first became committed to reform. As he later put it to the Roman people, many of the men who fought Rome's wars are called masters of the world, but have not a patch of earth to call their own. To him, that was not fair. How far the smallholders really had disappeared from the land has puzzled modern historians much more than it did their ancient counterparts. It is not difficult to see how an agricultural revolution of that kind might have been a logical consequence of Roman warfare and expansion. During the war against Hannibal, at the end of the 3rd century BCE, rival armies had tramped up and down the Italian peninsula for a couple of decades, with devastating effects on the farmland. The demands of service with the army overseas removed manpower from the agricultural workforce for years on end, leaving family farms without essential labour. Both these factors could have made smallholders particularly vulnerable to failure, bankruptcy, or buyouts by the rich, who used the wealth they acquired from overseas conquest to build up vast land holdings, worked as agricultural ranches by a glut of slave labour. One modern historian echoed the sentiments of Tiberius when he grimly summed this up. Whatever booty they came home with, many ordinary soldiers had been, in effect, fighting for their own displacement. A good proportion of them would have drifted to Rome or other towns in search of a living, so swelling the urban underclass. It is a plausible scenario, but there is not much hard evidence to back it up. Leaving aside the propagandist tone of Tiberius's eye-opening journey through Etruria, had he not travelled 40 miles north before, there are few archaeological traces of the new-style ranches he reported, and considerable evidence, on the contrary, for the widespread survival of small-scale farms. It is not even certain that either war damage or the absence of young unmarried men abroad would have had the devastating long-term effect that is often imagined. Most agricultural land recovers quickly from that kind of trauma. And there would have been plenty of other family members to recruit to the workforce, and even if not, a few slave labourers would have been within the means of even relatively humble farmers. In fact, many historians now think that if his motives were sincere, Tiberius seriously misread the situation. Whatever the economic truth, however, he certainly saw the problem in terms of the displacement of the poor from farming land. So did the poor themselves. If the story of their graffiti campaign in Rome, urging him to restore land to the poor, is true. And it was this problem that Tiberius determined to solve when he was elected a tribune of the people for 133 BCE. He straightaway introduced a law to the plebeian assembly to reinstate smallholders by distributing plots of Roman public land to the poor. This was part of the territory that Romans had seized in their takeover of Italy. In theory, it was open to a wide range of users, but in practice, rich Romans and rich Italians had grabbed much of it and turned it, to all intents and purposes, into their private property. Tiberius proposed to restrict their holdings to a maximum of 500 jugera, roughly 120 hectares each. Claiming that this was the old legal limit and to parcel out the rest in small units to the dispossessed. It was a typical style of Roman reform, justifying radical action as a return to past practice. The proposal prompted a series of increasingly bitter controversies. First, when one of his fellow tribunes, Marcus Octavius, repeatedly tried to veto it, some right of veto had been given to these people's representatives centuries earlier. Tiberius rode roughshod over the objection and had the people vote his opponent out of office. This enabled the law to pass, and a board of three commissioners was established, a rather cosy group comprising Tiberius, his brother and his father-in-law, to oversee the reassigning of land. Next, when the Senate, whose interests generally lay with the rich, refused to make any more than a nugatory grant of cash to fund the operation, a blocking device well known in modern political disputes, Tiberius again turned to the people and persuaded them to vote to divert a recent state windfall to finance the commission. By a convenient coincidence, King Attalus III of Pergamum had died in 133 BCE, and, combining a realistic assessment of Roman power in the eastern Mediterranean with a shrewd defence against assassination by rivals at home, he had made the Roman people the heir to his property and large kingdom in what is now Turkey. This inheritance provided all the money needed for the commission's complex job of investigating, measuring and surveying, selecting new tenants and setting them up with the basic tools of the farming trade. Finally, when Tiberius found himself increasingly attacked and even accused of aiming at kingship, one nasty rumour hinted that he had been eyeing up the royal diadem and purple robes of Attalus. He decided to defend his position by standing for election as tribune again the following year. For as an office holder, he would be immune from prosecution. This was too much for some of his anxious opponents, and a posse of them, senators and assorted thugs, with improvised weapons and no official authority whatsoever, interrupted the elections. Roman elections were time-consuming affairs. In the plebeian assembly, which chose the tribunes, the electorate came together in a single place and the tribal groups voted in turn, each man, of many thousands, casting his vote individually one after the other. Sometimes more than a day was needed to complete the process. In 133 BCE, the votes for the next year's tribunes were slowly being delivered on the Capitoline Hill when the posse invaded. A battle followed, in which Tiberius was bludgeoned to death with a chair leg. The man behind the lynch mob was his cousin, Publius Cornelius Scipio Nasica Serapio, an ex-consul, and the head of one of the main groups of Roman priests, the Pontifices. He is said to have entered this deadly brawl, having drawn his toga over his head, as Roman priests usually did when sacrificing animals to the gods. He was trying, presumably, to make the murder look like a religious act. The death of Tiberius did not stop the work of redistributing the land. A replacement was found for him on the commission, and its activity over the next few years can still be traced in a series of boundary stones marking the intersections of the new property units, each one blazoning the names of the commissioners responsible. But there were more casualties, too, on both sides. Some of the Gracchan supporters were put on trial in a special court established by the Senate, on what charge is not clear, and at least one was put to death by being tied up in a sack with poisonous snakes, most likely an ingenious piece of invented tradition masquerading as a horrible, archaic Roman punishment. Scipio Nasica was quickly packed off on a convenient delegation to Pergamum, where he died the next year. Scipio Aemilianus, whose reaction to the news of the murder of Tiberius had been to quote another line of Homer to the effect that he had brought it on himself, returned to Italy from fighting in Spain to take up the cause of those rich Italian allies who were being ejected from public land. He was found dead in his bed in 129 BCE, on the very morning when he was due to give a speech on their behalf. Unexplained deaths, and there were many of them, provoked Roman suspicion. In both these cases, there were rumours of foul play. Some Romans, as they often did when no evidence was available, alleged malign female influence behind the scenes. The triumphant conqueror of Carthage, they claimed, had been the victim of a tawdry domestic murder by his wife and mother-in-law, who were determined that he should not undo the work of Tiberius Gracchus, their brother and son. Why was Tiberius's land reform so bitterly contested? All kinds of self-interest were no doubt at work. Some observers at the time, and since, claimed that far from being genuinely concerned with the plight of the poor, Tiberius was driven by a grudge against the Senate, which had humiliatingly refused to ratify a treaty he had negotiated when he was serving in Spain. Many of the wealthy must have resented losing land that they had long treated as part of their private estates, while those who were set to benefit from the distribution eagerly supported the reform. In fact, many flooded into the city from outlying areas of Roman territory, specially to vote for it. But there was more to the conflict than that. The clash in 133 BCE revealed dramatically different views of the power of the people. When Tiberius persuaded them to vote out of office the tribune who opposed him, his argument went along the lines of, if the people's tribune no longer does what the people want, then he should be deposed. That raised an issue still familiar in modern electoral systems. Are members of Parliament, for example, to be seen as delegates of the voters, bound to follow the will of their electorate, or are they representatives elected to exercise their own judgment in the changing circumstances of government? This was the first time, so far as we know, that this question had been explicitly raised in Rome, and it was no more easily answered then than it is now. For some, Tiberius's actions vindicated the rights of the people. For others, they undermined the rights of a properly elected official. Similar dilemmas were at the bottom of the dispute over whether Tiberius should be re-elected as a tribune. Holding an office for two consecutive years back to back was not unprecedented, but some certainly thought it signalled a dangerous build-up of individual power and was another hint of monarchical ambitions. Others claimed that the Roman people had the right to elect whomsoever they wanted, no matter what the electoral conventions were. What is more, if Attalus had left his kingdom to the Roman people, Populus Romanus, was it not up to them, rather than the Senate, to determine how the bequest was used? Should not the profits of empire benefit the poor as well as the rich? Scipio Nasica, with his thugs, cudgels and chair-legs, does not come across as an attractive character, and the surname Vespillo, or Undertaker, given to the senator who saw to the disposal of the bodies in the Tiber, is an uncomfortable joke by any standards, ancient or modern. But their argument with Tiberius was a fundamental one, which framed Roman political debate for the rest of the Republic. Cicero, looking back from the middle of the next century, could present 133 BCE as a decisive year, precisely because it opened up a major fault line in Roman politics and society that was not closed again during his lifetime. The death of Tiberius Gracchus, he wrote, and even before that, the whole rationale behind his tribunate divided a united people into two distinct groups, partes. This is a rhetorical oversimplification. The idea that there had been a calm consensus at Rome between rich and poor until Tiberius Gracchus shattered it is at best a nostalgic fiction. It seems likely, from what is known of the political debates in the decade or so before 133 BCE, which is not much, that others had already asserted the rights of the people along much the same lines. In 139 BCE, for example, one radical tribune had introduced a law to ensure that Roman elections were conducted by secret ballot. There is little evidence to help flesh out the man behind this, or to throw light on the opposition it must have aroused, though Cicero gives a hint when he says that everyone knows that the ballot law robbed the aristocrats of all their influence, and describes the proposer as a filthy nobody. But it was a milestone reform and a fundamental guarantee of political freedom for all citizens, and one that was unknown in elections in the classical Greek world, democratic or not. Nevertheless, it was the events of 133 BCE that crystallized the opposition between those who championed the rights, liberty and benefits of the people, and those who, to put it in their own terms, thought it prudent for the state to be guided by the experience and wisdom of the best men, optimi, who in practice were more or less synonymous with the rich. Cicero uses the word partes for those two groups, populares and optimates, as they were sometimes called. But they were not parties in the modern sense. They had no members, official leaders, or agreed manifestos. They represented two sharply divergent views of the aims and methods of government, which were repeatedly to clash for almost 100 years. Gaius Gracchus. In one of the Roman world's most quoted jibes, the satirist Juvenal, writing at the end of the 1st century CE, turns his scorn on the mob of Remus, which, he claimed, wanted just two things, bread and circuses, panem et circenses. As the currency of that phrase even now shows, it was a brilliant dismissal of the limited horizons of the urban rabble, presented here as if they were the descendants of the murdered twin. They cared for nothing but the chariot racing and food handouts, with which the emperors had bribed and effectively depoliticized them. It was also a cynical misrepresentation of the Roman tradition of providing staple food for the people at state expense, which originated with Tiberius's younger brother, Gaius Sempronius Gracchus, a tribune of the people in two consecutive years, 123 and 122 BCE. Gaius did not introduce a corn dole, to be precise. He successfully proposed a law to the plebeian assembly, establishing that the state should sell a certain quantity of grain each month at a subsidized, fixed price to individual citizens in the city. Even so, the scale and ambition of this initiative were enormous, and Gaius seems to have planned the considerable infrastructure needed to support it. The public purchasing, distribution facilities, and some form of identity checking, how otherwise did you restrict it to citizens, as well as storage in new public warehouses built by the Tiber and rented lock-up space in others. How the whole operation was staffed and organized day to day is not known for certain. Public officials at Rome were given only the skeletal support of a few scribes, messengers and bodyguards, So, as with most of the state's responsibilities, right down to such tiny specialist jobs as repainting the face of the statue of the god Jupiter in his temple overlooking the city from the Capitoline Hill, much of the work of managing and distributing the grain was presumably in the hands of private contractors, who made money out of delivering public services. Gaius's initiative came partly out of concern for the poor in the city. In good years, the crops of Sicily and Sardinia would have been more or less sufficient to feed a quarter of a million people, a reasonable, though slightly conservative, estimate for the population of Rome in the later 2nd century BCE. But ancient Mediterranean harvests fluctuated dramatically, and prices sometimes went far beyond what many ordinary Romans, shopkeepers, craftsmen, day labourers, could afford. Even before Gaius, the state had sometimes taken preemptive measures to avoid famine in the city. One revealing inscription found in Thessaly in northern Greece records the visit of a Roman official in 129 BCE. He had come, cap in hand, because the situation in his country at the present time is one of dearth. And he went away with the promise of more than 3,000 tons of wheat, and some very complicated transportation arrangements in place. Charitable aims, however, were not the only thing in Gaius's mind, nor even the hard-headed logic, sometimes in evidence at Rome, that a hungry populace was a dangerous one. His plan also had an underlying political agenda about the sharing of the state's resources. That certainly is the point of a reported exchange between Gaius and one of his most implacable opponents, the wealthy ex-consul Lucius Calpurnius Piso Frugi. His last name, appropriately enough, means stingy. After the law had been passed, Gaius spotted Frugi standing in line for his allocation of grain and asked him why he was there, since he so disapproved of the measure. "I'm not keen, Gracchus," he replied, "on you getting the idea of sharing out my property man by man, but if that's what you're going to do, I'll take my cut." He was presumably turning Gaius's rhetoric back on him. The debate was about who had a claim on the property of the state and where the boundary lay between private and public wealth. The distribution of cheap grain was Gaius's most influential reform. Though it was amended and occasionally suspended over the decades that followed, its basic principle lasted for centuries. Rome was the only place in the ancient Mediterranean where the state took responsibility for the regular basic food supplies of its citizens. The Greek world, by contrast, had usually relied on occasional handouts in times of shortage, or sporadic displays of generosity on the part of the rich. But food distribution were only one of Gaius's many innovations. Unlike all earlier Roman reformers, Gaius sponsored not just a single initiative, but a dozen or so. He was the first politician in the city, leaving aside the mythical founding fathers, to have an extensive and coherent programme, with measures that covered such things as the right of appeal against the death penalty, the outlawing of bribery, and a much more ambitious scheme of land distribution than Tiberius had ever proposed. This involved exporting surplus citizens en masse to colonies, not only in Italy but also, for the first time, overseas. Just a couple of decades after it had been razed and cursed, Carthage was earmarked as a new town to be resettled. But Roman memory was not so short, and this particular project was soon cancelled, even though some settlers had already emigrated there. It is impossible now to list all the legislation that Gaius proposed in just 2 years, still less to determine precisely what its terms and aims were. Apart from a substantial section of the text of a law governing the behaviour of Roman officials abroad, and providing means of redress to those whom they abused, which we shall explore in the next chapter, the surviving evidence comes largely in the form of passing asides, or much later reconstructions. But it is the range that is the key. To Gaius's opponents, that smacked dangerously of a bid for personal power. The programme overall certainly seems to have added up to a systematic attempt to reconfigure the relationship between the people and the Senate. That is how his Greek biographer, Plutarch, in full, Lucius Mestrius Plutarchus, understood it more than 200 years later, when he singled out what must have been a flamboyant gesture by Gaius, as he addressed his audiences in the Forum. Speakers before him had faced the Senate House, with the audience squashed together in the small area known as the Comitium, just in front of it. Gaius flouted convention by strategically turning his back on the Senate House when talking to the people, who now listened in the open piazza of the Forum. It was, Plutarch concedes, just a slight deviation in practice, but it made a revolutionary point. Not only did it allow the participation of a much larger crowd, it signalled the freedom of the people from the controlling eye of the Senate. Ancient writers, in fact, credit Gaius with a particularly sharp sense of the politics of place. Another story tells how, when there was to be a display of gladiators in the Forum, a favourite location before the Colosseum was built 200 years later, a number of high-ranking Romans put up temporary seating to hire out for profit. During the night before the show, Gaius had it all dismantled so that the ordinary people would have plenty of space to watch without paying. Unlike his elder brother, Gaius somehow succeeded in being elected tribune twice, but in murky circumstances. He failed to be elected again for 121 BCE. In that year he resisted the efforts of the consul Lucius Opimius, a diehard who became something of a hero to the conservatives, to cancel much of his legislation. In the process he was killed, or he killed himself to forestall murder, by an armed gang under Opimius's command. The violence was not one-sided. It had broken out after one of the consul's attendants, apparently going to and fro with the innards from some animal that had just been sacrificed, which added a macabre touch to the scene, shouted some casual abuse at Gaius's supporters. "Let the decent guys pass, you tossers," and made an even ruder gesture. They turned on him and stabbed him to death with their writing styluses, a clear sign that they were not already armed, that they were a literate group, but that they were not merely innocent victims. In response, the Senate passed a decree urging the consuls to make sure that the state should come to no harm, the same Emergency Powers Act as was later passed during Cicero's clash with Catiline in 63 BCE. Opimius took the cue, gathered together an amateur militia of his supporters, and put some 3,000 Gracchans to death, either on the spot or later in an impromptu court. It established a dubious and deadly precedent. For this was the first occasion of several over the next 100 years when this decree was used to confront various crises, from civil disorder to alleged treason. It may have been devised as an attempt to put some kind of regulatory framework on the use of official force. Rome at this period had no police of any kind and hardly any resources for controlling violence beyond what individual powerful men could scratch together. The instruction to make sure that the state should come to no harm could, in theory, have been intended to draw a line between the unauthorised actions of a Scipio Nasica and those sanctioned by the Senate. In practice, it was a lynch mob's charter, a partisan excuse to suspend civil liberties and a legal fig leaf for premeditated violence against radical reformers. It is, for example, hard to believe that the Cretan archers who joined Opimius's local supporters were on hand purely by chance. But the decree was always controversial and always liable to rebound, as Cicero discovered. Opimius was duly put on trial, and though he was acquitted, his reputation never entirely recovered. When he had the nerve, or naivety, to celebrate his suppression of the Gracchans by lavishly restoring the temple of the goddess Concord, Harmony, in the Forum, some realist with a chisel summed up the whole murderous debacle by carving across the façade the words, "An act of senseless discord produces a temple of concord." Citizens and Allies at War. Shortly before Gaius's revolutionary reforms, in the mid-120s BCE, a Roman consul was travelling through Italy with his wife and came to the small town of Teanum, modern Teano, about 100 miles south of Rome. The lady decided she wanted to use the baths there, usually reserved for men, so the mayor had them prepared for her and the regular bathers thrown out. But she complained that the facilities were neither ready in time nor clean enough. So a stake was set up in the Forum, and Teanum's mayor, the most distinguished man in the town, was taken and tied to it. His clothes were stripped off, and he was beaten with sticks. This story has come down to us because it was told in a speech by Gaius Gracchus, which was quoted verbatim by a literary scholar of the 2nd century CE, interested in analysing his oratorical style. It was a shocking example of Roman abuse of power, cited in support of yet another of Gaius's campaigns, to extend Roman citizenship more widely in Italy. He was not the first to suggest this. His proposal was part of a growing controversy about the status of Rome's allies and the Latin communities in Italy. It ended with many of the allies going to war on Rome in the Social War, one of the deadliest and most puzzling conflicts in Roman history. The puzzle turns largely on what the aim of the allies were. Did they resort to violence to force Rome to grant them full Roman citizenship? Or were they trying to shake themselves free of Rome? Did they want in or out? The relations between Rome and the other Italians had developed in different directions since the 3rd century BCE. The Allies had certainly reaped handsome rewards from their joint campaigns with Rome, in the form of the booty that came with victory and the commercial opportunities that followed. One family in the little town of Fregellae, technically a Latin colony, 60 miles south of Rome, was proud enough of these campaigns to decorate their house with terracotta friezes depicting the distant battles in which some of them had served. On a grander scale, the spectacular architectural development of many Italian towns provides concrete evidence of the Allies' profit. At Praeneste, for example, just over 20 miles from Rome, a vast new sanctuary of the goddess Fortune was built, a masterpiece of display architecture, with a theatre, terracing, porticos and colonnades to rival anything anywhere else in the Mediterranean. It is hardly a coincidence that the names of several families from this town are found among those of the Roman and Italian traders on the Aegean island of Delos, one of the biggest commercial centres at the time and a hub of the slave trade. To outsiders in places such as Delos, there was precious little difference between Romans and Italians, and the terms were used more or less interchangeably to refer to both. Even in Italy, the boundaries were becoming blurred or eroded. By the early 2nd century BCE, all those who had been citizens without the vote had gained the vote. At some point before the Social War, the Romans may have agreed that anyone who had held public office in a community with Latin status should be eligible for full Roman citizenship. In practice, a blind eye was often turned to Italians who simply claimed citizenship or got away with formally enrolling themselves at a Roman census. Yet this kind of closer integration was only one side of it. Gaius's story of the Italian mayor is just one of a series of causes célèbres in which individual Romans, on a scale from tactless to cruel, were said to have hurt or humiliated prominent members of the allied communities. Another consul reputedly had a group of local dignitaries stripped and flogged because of some slip-up with his supply arrangements. True or not, and all of them come ultimately from uncorroborated attacks by Romans on other Romans, these anecdotes suggest an atmosphere of recrimination, bitterness, and poisonous gossip, which was further fueled by some high-handed actions on the part of the Roman state, and a sense of political exclusion and second-class status on the part of leading allies. The Senate began to take it for granted that it could lay down the law for the whole of Italy. Tiberius Gracchus's land reform, popular as it might have been to poor Romans, was a provocation to rich Italians whose public land was removed, while excluding poor Italians from the distributions. The close personal relationships that some of the Italian elite had with leading Romans, how else did they enlist Scipio Aemilianus to help against Tiberius's land reform, did not make up for the fact that they had no formal stake in Roman politics or decision-making. In the 120s BCE, the Italian question became increasingly divisive and provoked bouts of violent conflict. In 125 BCE, the people of Fragilae attempted to break away from Rome, but were crushed by a Roman army under the same Lucius Opimius, who a few years later eliminated Gaius Gracchus. The remains of the friezes that had once proudly celebrated those joint campaigns were unearthed 2,000 years later from the wreckage of Fragilae's destruction. At the same time, in Rome, fears about outsiders flooding into the city were whipped up in a way familiar from many modern campaigns of xenophobia. One of Gaius's opponents, addressing a contio, or public meeting, conjured up visions of Romans being swamped. "Once you have given citizenship to the Latins," he urged his audience, "I mean, do you think there will be any space for you, like there is now? In a contio, or at games or festivals, don't you realise they'll take over everything?" There were also occasionally formal attempts to repatriate immigrants, or to prevent Italians from passing themselves off as full Roman citizens. It could prove dangerous to be too prominent a supporter of the Italian cause. In the autumn of 91 BCE, the proposal of one Marcus Livius Drusus to extend citizen rights more widely in Italy ended with him being murdered at home, knifed as he was saying goodbye to a crowd of visitors. That murder heralded full-blown war on a terrible scale. The tipping point came at the end of 91 BCE, when a Roman envoy insulted the people of Asculum in southern Italy. They responded by killing him and all the other Romans in the town. This brutal piece of ethnic cleansing set the tone for what followed, which was not far short of civil war. It can be called a war against Socii to lessen the odium of it. The truth is, it was civil war against citizens, as one Roman historian later summed it up. And it involved fighting throughout much of the peninsula, including at Pompeii, where the marks of the battering by the Roman artillery in 89 BCE can be seen even now on the city walls. The Romans invested enormous force to defeat the Italians, and won victory at the cost of heavy losses and considerable panic. After one consul was killed in battle, there was such grief in Rome when his body was brought back that the Senate decreed that, in future, casualties should be buried where they fell, a decision that some modern states have also taken. But most of the conflict was over relatively quickly, within a couple of years. Peace was apparently hastened by one simple expedient. The Romans offered full citizenship to those Italians who had not taken up arms against Rome or were prepared to lay them down. That certainly makes it look as if the aim of many allies in going to war had been to become fully Roman, ending their political exclusion and inferior status. That is how most ancient writers explain the conflict. They were seeking citizenship of the state whose power they were used to defending with their arms, insists one, whose great-grandfather was an Italian who fought on the Roman side.